Welcome back to hour number two of Mance and Mitchell. I'm Gary Mance.
I'm still Suzanne Mitchell.
You still are. At last report, still Suzanne Mitchell. And, of course, our audio wizard, our buddy Mike Robert, is handling everything on his end. He has sort of the crow's nest position there in Puget Sound and bringing us to you. Delighted to have you with us. In this second hour, it is our privilege once again to talk to a man with a versatile intellect, and I don't know if he gets told that very often. I would think that he
would. Probably every day.
It's amazing. I subscribe to his newsletter, and a bit later in the hour, Stefan A. Schwartz will tell you how you can sign up as well. A fund of information like no other. Really amazing stuff, particularly if you take not only the metaphysical perspective on life, but also if you are concerned about geopolitics, if you're concerned about politics and money, about elections and how they get to be that way, and a mass of individual issues which, looked at collectively, can look like a hell of a mess. And the status quo is certainly challenging, so we thought we would get Stefan on the show today so that we could pick some of this apart as much as an hour will allow, and Stefan can shed some light on many, many things in the news. Let's go ahead and give him his mad props, and then we'll jump in.
Stefan A. Schwartz is a distinguished consulting faculty of Saybrook University and a research associate of the Cognitive Sciences Laboratory of the Laboratories for Fundamental Research. He's the editor of the daily web publication SchwartzReport.net.
Say that three times fast.
I knew I was going to get that wrong. SchwartzReport.net. In both of which he covers trends that are affecting the future. He also writes regularly for the Huffington Post. His website is StefanAschwartz.com, which we will try and remember to give out again before the end of the hour. Welcome to Mance and Mitchell again, Stefan Schwartz. How are you today?
How are you? I hope you guys are good. Appreciate being asked back.
And you're not at all intimidated by a buildup like that when you have the curriculum vitae of a Stefan A. Schwartz. You're ready to tackle, as I said on Facebook today, about everything under the sun.
Well, we'll tackle at least some of it anyway.
I'll tell you, Stefan, I am getting nostalgic for the days early this summer when the most I had to worry about as I glared at the TV news was the faces of angry people and how they contorted into masks of hatred as they shouted at a bus full of child refugees coming up from South America. Yeah. And I'm starting to think of those as the good old days.
Well, the trends are not good. I'm sorry. It always makes me feel very bad to say that, but our trends are not good. We need to make changes. And it really will fall on us as individuals to do that.
You know, that was one of the things that interested me the most when I was looking at your website and also researching for today's show, is the idea that you have that one person or a very small group of people can make a difference. And when we start feeling so helpless, you know, you wonder how is that going to come about? What is it that I can do? What is it that one person can do? And you say it can be done based on the way we live, based on our consciousness.
It depends on our consciousness, but I mean, it's not some sort of wild speculative theory. It has been done, actually done quite frequently. People don't recognize that, but I can tell you right now, just as we speak here, that if all of the listeners who hear this radio program would do one small thing, we could change the election. And that's really quite simple. Whenever you're faced with a choice, if you will choose the most compassionate and life-affirming choice of the options that are available, may not be the most compassionate and life-affirming choice there could be, but if you will always skew toward that option which is the most compassionate and life-affirming, whenever you make a decision, and if you will tell 10 friends that that's what you're doing and invite them to join you, and in turn ask 10 people they know, between now and November when the election is held, we would skew the election toward the compassionate and life-affirming. Not a huge
Stephen,
effect.
I agree with,
doesn't
I
have
agree
to
with
be
you,
a huge
Stephen.
Effect. But yes. It's like 81 milligram aspirin. Every middle-aged man in America, I think, takes 81 milligram aspirin. The actual effect that it produces in terms of cardiovascular protection is really not very large, but over a whole population, it's sufficiently significant that that everybody is told to do it by their physicians. The actual effect is considerably smaller than, for instance, the effect size of remote viewing experiments. So this is really quite powerful, and it doesn't require any money, doesn't require any political debate, doesn't require that you go out and buy something. It's just very simple. Whenever you are faced with a choice, if you look at the options that are available to you and you choose that one that is the most compassionate and life-affirming, and you do this consistently and you tell your friends you're doing it and invite them to join you, just do the math. It's amazing how quickly this would build up.
I love that, Stephen, because that helps a great deal if that becomes, in essence, your compass pointing true north. If that is the standard, it's wonderful because we have a barrage, as you well know, of propaganda. Now, from my point of view, of course, left versus right, Democrat versus Republican. Of course, we're going to have that in every election cycle. But the people who are putting out which messages tell the tale. And you need to have your compass pointing north, because if you're choosing from a standpoint of what is life-affirming, you're going to say yes to certain people and ideas and parties and no to the others, because the distinction in 2014 in America is just that trenchant. It's just that sheer.
Yes, absolutely. It has nothing to do with politics. You don't need to concern yourself with that. You don't need to concern yourself with any of these other things. You just do one thing. I will choose that which is the most compassionate and life-affirming option as I understand it in that moment of the options that are available for me. And I will consistently do this day by day, and I will tell 10 people that I'm doing this and invite them to join me. I mean, you just do the math. You get 10 people, and each of them ask 10 people, and each of those 10 people ask 10 people, and pretty soon you're up into the millions. And we know from research how many people it takes to change things. It takes about 10% of any group to make a decision in a certain direction in order for the entire group to change. And so we're talking about 24 million people out of the 317 million in the United States. If the people who could vote would all vote, for instance, to serve that which is compassionate and life-affirming, then we would change the election. It's very simple.
And for the sake of historical context, just to, and I think you're proving your point without any assistance from me, but just to accentuate it, I remember I was politically precocious when I was a youngster. I took civics in middle school, eighth grade. I took civics in the spring of 1968. Hello. The spring of 1968, that was the semester in middle school when I learned about how government works or doesn't work. And I can recall that Eugene McCarthy, and I think a lot of people have forgotten this, but it's essential to remember, the peace candidate, the dove, Eugene McCarthy, trudging in the snows of New Hampshire, only got 42% of the vote. He lost the New Hampshire primary to Lyndon Baines Johnson, and it was enough to knock Johnson out of the race altogether.
Yeah, well, you know, sometimes, although everybody tells you it's all very complicated and you're powerless and what can I do and it doesn't make any difference who I vote for or any of that, that's simply a lie. It's just agitprop. But the problem we have is that they've just done a survey, for instance, showing that 64% of Americans cannot name the three branches of government. I don't mean who occupies them. I just mean they don't know who the three branches of government are. It's very discouraging. But even you can put even that aside. If everybody would just make this slight skew by making this choice, we would get a different outcome. Because if you choose that which is the most life-affirming and compassionate thing, and I choose the most life-affirming and compassionate thing, and Marilyn chooses the most life-affirming and compassionate thing, then, and we all pass that along to other people, then even though we may have slightly different versions of what is the most compassionate and life-affirming, but overall across the entire country, that little skew would produce an enormous difference. I've been watching the Roosevelts, the Ken Burns wonderful
Isn't it great?
Series, and I must say I saw last night about World War II and the vision of Franklin Roosevelt. It's just astonishing. But that's exactly what he was trying to do in reaching out to the American people, was to create this slight skew in favor of that which is compassionate and life-affirming. That's what got Social Security created. That's what got Medicare created. That's what got all of the programs that help us and that give us support for the elderly and the poor. When people benefit generally, everyone benefits, because, you know, behaviors change. I live on a little island off the coast of Washington. We have 26,000 people live on this island. And before I moved here a number of years ago, I looked at the social outcomes, because I only want to make one last move in my life. And so I looked at this little community, and its average income was about $26,000, which is just above, for a family, is just above poverty line. And I thought, oh dear, they're going to have all kinds of bad social outcomes, because when you have a lot of poverty, you experience socially, at the sort of collective social level, you expect to see a lot of acting out, drinking, drug usage, spousal abuse, teen pregnancies, child abuse, all the things that people who are desperate and poor, oftentimes just can't seem to get out of. And instead, when I looked at the social outcomes, I discovered that on Whidbey that we didn't have any of that. The crime is somebody's dog is walking on my lawn. And so I thought, what is going on here? And when I did further research and dug down into it, I realized that quite apart from any government or anything, any official program that was going on, there was this whole interlocking network of social efforts. And my wife, for instance, bakes 6 dozen organic breakfast, luncheon treats that she and a whole group of other women make to feed, to make sure that all of the low-income children on the island have a proper nutrition. So they make this food and they send it home on the weekend in what they call backpack lunches, and it's enough for 3 people. And this is all done on a volunteer basis. We have a big organic garden that's done by the community that makes it available for anybody. We have a soup kitchen where anyone can go and get a lunch. And on and on and on. All these little programs that are all individually quite within the realm of what a private person could do with no particular money, no government support. But the net of it is we have no graffiti. We have very little obesity. We have another huge issue. We have very little spousal abuse. We have a lower divorce rate, and on and on. And these social outcomes are driven because the people in the community, the affluent people in the community, and the low-income people do not treat one another as two different classes. They treat one another as neighbors, and some of the neighbors are having a hard time, and so you help them out. And just that little bit, changes the whole ambiance of the community. Benjamin Franklin understood this. In his will, one of the things he did was leave money. He created micro-lending, among other things, but he also left money to build baths and parks and hospitals, and because he said, and this is absolutely true, where people have a comfortable and attractive environment and feel that they are supported by the community, they support the community. And just that little change that he made, one guy, still has effects to over 200 years later, and his little micro-lending program is today, over 200 years later, about 3,500 kids are going to college, mostly young people of color and low income, who are going to college because of Benjamin Franklin sitting under his mulberry tree in Philadelphia in 1789. It's extraordinary.
Well, it is. And these outsized effects, it's like these little acts pay dividends for perhaps centuries down the road. But even if we're only talking about decades, this is the effect of an individual who is committed with clarity to a purpose. So I'm glad that Ben Franklin, among all the things that he did, something as small as that it easily gets overlooked when you're reading the biography of the man. But here he had this outsized effect on society. We'd like to talk more about that with you, Stephen A. Schwartz, a very honored guest, a man with a versatile intellect. You can ask the guy anything, and he'll give you a very intelligent and informed response. So we're going to tap in. We're going to pick his brain some more is what we're going to do on the other side of this short break. Give us a couple of minutes, then more of Manson Mitchell right here on Seattle's Alternative Talk, AM 1150.
Staying connected with Gary Mance and Suzanne Mitchell is easy. Just go to mansonmitchell.com for the latest info on topics and guests. Sign up for early notice about future shows on a spam-free listserv. Friend Gary Mance and Suzanne Mitchell on their Facebook pages and like the Manson Mitchell show page at facebook.com/mansonmitchell. If you're on Twitter, share a follow with Gary and Suzanne at Mance Mitchell. Join Gary and Suzanne Friday and Saturday mornings at 10 a.m. for an unusual show that covers everything from personal growth to the paranormal.
Here's an amazing act. Here's a tremendous act. Here's a startling act. The amazing, the thrilling, the greatest, spectacular, incredible, exciting, wonderful, world fame, most unusual novelty act.
The home of the A-Team of Alternative Talk is mansonmitchell.com. Heard right here on Alternative Talk 1150 a.m. or streaming live from your computer anywhere.
Make new friends and reconnect with old ones. It only happens twice a year, and you'll want to be there Saturday, September 27 for the Emerald Spiral Expo from 9 a.m. to 5 p.m. at the Kent Commons in Kent, Washington. The cafe inside the expo offers a wide variety of freshly made items, both breakfast and lunch, so you can park and stay as long as you like. Door prizes are drawn and announced every hour. The free parking, free entry, free speakers, and the best readers, healers, and vendors providing intuitive healing services. Browse the aisles for crystals, stones, jewelry, books, clothing, and health products. For more information, go to emeraldspiral.com or give them a call at 206-508-1270 for more information. It only happens twice a year, and you will want to be there Saturday, September 27, 1 week from today, 9 a.m. to 5 p.m. at the Kent Commons in Kent, Washington. Go to emeraldspiral.com, call 206-508-1270, and when you get to the expo, tell them you heard about it on Manson Mitchell.
Even doctors in the most sophisticated tests can't always find the source of a health issue. But there's one authority that always knows, your own body. Hi, this is Maureen Magnucheri, the host of Where Energy and Medicine Meet.
At a brand new time slot, Thursdays at 9 a.m. You don't want to miss her exciting guests along with her wonderful insight.
Check the events page on my website to find out where I'm doing book signings in your area. And don't forget to tune in on Thursdays for the Maureen Magnucheri Show.
Radio with no added hormones or preservatives. All natural, Alternative Talk, 1150 AM.
Best be theater,
Welcome back to Manson Mitchell and our guest today, Stephan A. Schwartz. As Gary says, he can talk about almost anything. What we were talking about before the break had to do with how one person or a small number of people can change something one way or another. We played our little bumper music, Liar, Liar, because I'm thinking about how you are describing something which is actually taking place, Stephan, in the place where you live. And yet, when, you know, Gary and I watch the news, I don't know what we're looking at. It doesn't seem like there is very much of people taking care of other people. It looks like a lot of greed out there, a lot of lying, a lot of manipulation. And so, is this something that we have bought into that's not true? Is this a lie that we are under the thumbs of big oil and big pharma and big agra?
Yeah, we've bought into it. You're powerless. What can you do? You're just an ordinary woman in Seattle. What could you possibly do? How could you make any effect? That's what everybody tells you. Oh, and it doesn't make any difference which party you vote for. Everybody knows they're all corrupt. They're all the same. All of that stuff that comes out just gets spewed out. All of that is saying to you, you're powerless, you're powerless, you're powerless. And it's not true. I'll give you just a couple of big social examples that have just occurred that everybody will recognize. Look at the difference in marijuana prohibition. 10 years ago, the idea that they were going to legalize marijuana in Washington State or Colorado, and it's going to happen in Oregon and Alaska, I think, very quickly, and probably in the District of Columbia. And medical marijuana is now in, 26 states, 23 states. Then that just would have been unthinkable. And yet it's happening. Why is it happening? Because a lot of individual, supposedly powerless Americans are leaning and smiling in the direction they want to go. Look at another example. Look at marriage equality. How many years ago is it now? 10 years ago that California passed a proposal specifically against it. It was considered unthinkable. And yet look at what has happened. Look at the change in the courts. Look at the change in the general population. Look at the change in young people who just simply find the whole idea that you should limit who people can marry that they're in love with to be repugnant. Or I'll give you a third one. This much smaller, but it still makes the point. I was fascinated last year, in the space of less than 6 months, we went from calling gay people to calling them LGBT. I don't know if you noticed that, but the entire media shifted in less than 6 months. Suddenly, nobody ever heard of LGBT, or not most Americans anyway, until about 6 months ago. And now it is the preferred term. Why did that happen? Was there some sort of rule that got passed, some sort of law? No, because individuals heard it, said, oh, yeah, that makes sense. That's what I'm going to say. And they did it. Or, oh, yes, that's not unreasonable. I know my cousin Fred. He is gay, and he's been in love with that guy for years and years. Or my Aunt Millie, and, you know, she's had that relationship with Doris for so many years. That's not such a bad idea. They seem to be very loving and caring about one another. I'm going to make a different choice. And it's those kinds of little quotidian choices, day-to-day, little tiny choices. And they have another aspect because there is a non-local linkage aspect to this. We know from research, again, that when there is a shift in awareness, Roger Nelson ran the Princeton Pair Engineering Anomalies Research Lab for about 20 years, was the lab manager along with Bob John and Brenda Dunn. They began doing studies showing that individuals could make random number generators go non-random through consciousness alone, just by intending it, holding intention-focused awareness, which is key to the whole thing. And Roger asked the next question, the intelligent next question, and that is, if this is happening at the individual level, is there a manifestation at the social level? So he established random number generators all over the world, literally all over the planet. And what he discovered was that when there was some event which catalyzed general collective consciousness in a very focused, specific way, particularly with a lot of emotion behind it, that his random number generators went non-random, like the death of Princess Diana or the tsunami in 2011 in Japan or Nelson Mandela's death recently. That when
9/11.
Things like that happen, they focus world consciousness, and it is such a clear focusing that Roger's random number generators go non-random. So there's
what was most interesting to me. What was most interesting to me about that, Stefan, was the fact that the numbers started changing before the event.
Right. Yes. Now, if we look at time as a linear sequence, a progression, moment to moment, now that's not supposed to happen. How could you have an emotional reaction to something that hasn't happened yet?
Well, not just an emotional reaction, but a physiological reaction. There are about 30 studies that have been done and published in the peer-reviewed literature on what are called presentment effects. Presentment's just a fancy word that means pre-knowing. And it's not about knowing, it's actually about a physiological response. I'll give you an example. Dean Radin, down at the Institute for Neurotic Sciences, has got an experiment where he asks you to look at a television monitor. And most of the time, there's just white noise. It's just nothing. There is no picture. And while you're looking at that, he has a macro camera that's looking at the iris of your eyes. And periodically, controlled by a random number generator, pictures appear on the television screen as you're staring at it. Not all the time, but occasionally, randomly. And what he discovered was that just before it happened, that is, before you knew that there was going to be a picture, your eyes would dilate. And more importantly, or as importantly, the nature of the picture made a difference. If the picture contained something that was very emotionally stimulative, either negative or positive, I mean, it could be a sexual image or a violence image or whatever, something that engaged your emotions or would engage your emotions when you saw it, your eyes dilated even more. And there are other experiments that people put on headphones and they listen to white noise in the background. And then every once in a while, again controlled by a random number generator so nobody knows when it's going to happen, a loud sound will occur. And just before it occurs, that part of your brain that processes auditory signals lights up in anticipation, a presentiment of the stimulus which is coming. So we are anticipatory. And as a result of that, if you see that at the individual level, and then you think, well, what is the social implication of that? And I think the social implication is terrific, and one of the things that is causing all the fear in this country, and that is we have a presentiment about what is coming in climate change. That's one. We have a presentiment and a fear, particularly among a certain group of white people, that for the first time in 500 years since the people came to Jamestown and the Mayflower, Plymouth Rock, that for the first time being born white will no longer confer privilege because we are going to be a majority-minority country. And, well, that probably doesn't bother you, and it probably doesn't bother most of your listeners, but trust me, it freaks out a lot of people. Another presentiment, people, our society has been structured holding women in a second-class status. One of the big hallmarks, almost an existential hallmark of religiosity is the suppression of women and sexual dysfunction. And so as women become more and more powerful because they compel us to treat them as we should, as equals, and not patronize them, well, that you and I probably think that's a great idea. I'm sure Marilyn does. But trust me when I tell you, the research literature is very clear that an awful lot of people find that very threatening. I mean, if you look at the ISIS thing that's going on, one of the hallmarks of this dreadful community of terrorists that we have actually played a large role in creating is that they are using rape as a weapon. They are, I mean, it's awful. It doesn't get much media coverage, but it's a huge issue.
Because
and
that's the least
of
what they do.
And anger. Hmm?
That's why it doesn't get much media coverage when they're cutting off people's heads and sending it out on video. Then rape seems like a second-class offense, and that's a horrible thing to have to say in itself. It's
unless
also
you're a woman who's been raped 50 times sequentially in a single day, which is happening, then you might have a slightly different view about that.
And you might find that there is virtually no place you can escape unless you have family
exactly.
that can protect you. But if you had that, you might not have had that experience in the first place. This business with ISIS is one of the things I wanted to take up with you, Stefan, because people are saying, well, we shouldn't get involved. I don't know that we really have the choice to simply withdraw from it, because it isn't that it's ideological, though it is. That isn't the worst part of it. This is a moving campaign of terror. It's a transnational phenomenon. And when that happens, it affects millions of people across a wide swath of the planet. And it seems to me, maybe you have a different point of view, but it seems to me that countries who have a more direct interest than ourselves, Iraq, to name one, Turkey, a member of NATO, to name another, are not in much of a rush to get involved as long as they can pull in Uncle Sam.
Well, I will tell you, my view of the whole ISIS thing is that it is the natural and logical conclusion of 13 years of bad foreign policy. And I'll give you an example. I lived in Egypt for 2 years, from 1979 to 1981. And that was a really tumultuous period. I mean, don't think about that now so much, but that was when the hostages were captured in Tehran. That was when the Sinai was given back by Israel to Egypt. That's when during the period that the Camp David Accords occurred. So, I mean, it was a very tumultuous period, as it is now. And when I lived in Egypt, the status place for young Kyrenes or Alexandrians to be, if you were a hip young person in Cairo or Alexandria, was to go to the USIA, United States Information Agency, library. We maintained a whole network of libraries across the world, and they were wonderful because people who lived in countries like Egypt at that time, where they had a lot of press censorship and very limited access to television and the kind of television. You could go if you were a young person and you could see Time magazine or Newsweek magazine or Ladies' Home Journal. They had a whole selection of magazines that you couldn't get out on the street. And they also had films you could watch that you couldn't see in the movie theater, and they had books that you could borrow and read and all sorts of things like that. Just very low key, they didn't push it. It was just there, and that's where kids would go, and that was what they talked about, and that was the status place to go hang out. And then when Ronald Reagan came in, he closed it all off and turned the money into military money. Well, it had a huge effect. And so when I look at that, and I remember my period of time and living in an Islamic society for several years while I was doing an archaeological project, a remote viewing project, what I came away with was that was money well spent. If we had poured it's now by some estimates up to $4 trillion or just directly about $1.5 trillion, that we have poured into these wars, I mean, you pick whatever number you like. If we had poured that into educational and health and gender equality and other just gentle, not aggressive, just smiling and leaning in the direction that was comp- compassionate and life-affirming. First of all, Islamic society across the world would be utterly different. What we have done instead is put all of the money into military things and poured huge sums of money, I mean, almost unbelievable sums of money, into a policy which doesn't work and isn't going to work. I mean, I have to tell you, Gary, that if they were dropping drones over my neighbors and one of my neighbors that I cared about had a drone hit them in the middle of the night and they got killed, or troops burst into their house at 3 in the morning and threw them on the floor and woke the kids up and threw them up against the wall, I'd be a cranky guy. And that's exactly what's happened. Every time we kill these people, 5 more sign up. I mean, ISIS is the result of a kind of perverse recruitment program. But it doesn't work. We have to make different choices. Clearly, killing people isn't getting us there. If it would, given all that have been killed, you'd think things would change. They don't.
And I don't have the answer for it. I wish I were enough of a foreign policy strategist to be able to offer a viable solution to this morass. But what I will say, Stefan, is that you're right on the money when you talk about ISIS having been in part created by America, the Bush-Cheney disaster that was the war in Iraq, that allowed Al-Qaeda to gain a foothold and to do their own share of recruiting. They didn't exist in Iraq prior to the fall of Saddam Hussein.
No, this is a result of, and what's even more dangerous is that it is so compelling to people who feel disaffected and cut off and powerless that hundreds of young people from our world, from the United States and even more from Europe, are going over there and participating in this. It's just astonishing to me. We have been doing something now for, it's 13 years. I mean, depending on how you calculate it exactly, the 91 first Bush campaign, whatever. But in any case, we have been following a program which produces worse outcomes than the outcomes before it. I mean, I will tell you, the Schwartz Report is available all over the world. And I actually have subscribers in Iraq. I don't have any idea who they are. I mean, they're not people I know. But anybody who can get to the Internet can subscribe to the Schwartz Report. And people write me. And I got an email not very long ago from a person in Iraq, a young doctor. Well, I don't know how young, a middle-aged doctor. Anyway, a physician who wrote to say to me, "Mr. Schwartz, I read your thing, and I just want to tell you that as bad as it was under Saddam Hussein, this is worse." Now, that's a horrible outcome. Think about that for a minute. If you were an Iraqi today, you would think that Saddam Hussein was the good old days.
That's right. And yet how they cheered when his statue was toppled and nobody knew what was going to come. I mean, the fall of Saddam and the horrible decision to de-Baathify, the Baathist party being the party of Saddam Hussein, to de-Baathify those people and, in essence, just cut them loose and leave them in the humiliating position of not having anything else to do but to join the insurgency, worked against us tragically.
Well, some of the leading ISIS generals are former Baathist generals in Saddam Hussein's army who we cut loose. Well, the reason that everybody welcomed us in the beginning was that they had this image of America. America was going to come. Everything would be made right. Things would get set up. They would be fair. The law would be reliable. We wouldn't be persecuted, blah, 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 all of that, because they knew the myth of World War II America. And instead what they got was greedy war contractors. I mean, it's worth noting that Dick Cheney got $34 million when he became vice president from Halliburton, and that Halliburton, in turn, got something like $34 billion in war contracts. I mean, if you read Life in the Emerald City, for instance, a book about what it was like at the very early occupation days, you can see the corruption, the war profiteering that went on. I mean, these wars have been horrible for about 1% of our population, all these kids that have gone over, and we're going to be reaping the havoc of that for a generation. I mean, there are millions, just the PTSD issue alone, there are hundreds of thousands of young men and women whose lives will never be the same, and therefore their families' lives will never be the same. I had a severely handicapped, I grew up with a severely handicapped brother. And the last 30 years of his life, after my parents were gone, I took care of him. And I can tell you, taking care of a severely handicapped person day in and day out is a real struggle. I mean, it is.
Sure, it is.
You take some 23-year-old who's come back with half his head blown off, and he's got a 23-year-old wife he's married. He married just before he went away, and they've got two kids or a kid. And she comes back, and suddenly this life that she thought she saw with this wonderful guy she was in love with, and he comes back and is largely dysfunctional, and that's her life suddenly. You don't think she's not depressed? I mean, we are going to pay for this for at least one and probably two generations.
That's something, Stefan, that I want to take up with you. Let's hold that thought. That's a great place to come back as we continue this discussion. I wish we weren't having it. I wish we were talking about fun stuff, but this is what we have, and we're going to deal with it directly. And more of that when we come back to Manson Mitchell. Give us a couple of minutes. We will be right back.
Are you suffering from SCS or slow computer syndrome? Well, tune in Saturdays from noon to 1 for Tech Talk with Craig. I'm Craig Walker, lead technician and owner of Coho Computer. We'll take your calls, answer your questions, keep you up to date with the latest in high-tech news, and feature special guests. Tech Talk with Craig, Saturdays noon to 1, right here on Alternative Talk 1150. I love my computer.
HeartMind Productions presents James Van Prague and An Evening of Spirit. It's happening at CSL Seattle on Sandpoint Way. James Van Prague will make his appearance with An Evening of Spirit, including messages from Spirit. Maybe one of them is meant for you. It's going to happen Friday, October 3, 7 p.m. to 9 p.m. But more on the way, a two-day intensive workshop, October 4 and 5. He's spending the whole weekend in Seattle. Saturday, October 4, starting at 9 a.m., Sunday, October 5, starting at 2 p.m., where he goes more in-depth and talks about the work of spirit communication and how you can start to work on your own form of mediumship, and you'll be learning from one of the masters. James Van Prague comes to Seattle, October 3, 4, and 5. Get your tickets now. The easiest way we know of is to go to spiritualliving.org/James. That's spiritualliving.org/James. Get your tickets now. This event will sell out. And if you get to meet James, give him a hug for us and say you heard all about it on Manson Mitchell.
On Friday, Manson Mitchell invite you to put on your dancing shoes as we play your favorite dance music.
On Saturday, Deborah Wilson joins us for 2 full hours to share how to be both spiritual and wealthy.
In the second hour, she'll be taking your calls to pass along messages from the angelic realm.
Manson Mitchell, Friday and Saturday mornings at 10 on Alternative Talk AM 1150.
News, traffic, and weather? Now you can get your information fixed weekdays on Alternative Talk 1150 AM.
Welcome back to Manson Mitchell and our interview with Stefan A. Schwartz, a very well-rounded intellectual, if ever there was one, and we're always delighted to have him join us. We're talking about matters of grave concern, We've heard on the news about ISIS. I have not watched, nor will I ever watch, the videos of these beheadings, but that's how serious geopolitics is getting in this day and age. And there are many run-ups, many causes for it. We're trying to pick through some of them and also to discuss what we might or might not do about it. Stefan, I wanted to mention, it was striking to me that there was a general, and I can't remember the man's name, but he testified before Congress, and he, just a few days ago, said that this was going to be a generational conflict. This fight to wipe out ISIS, to remove that scourge from the earth, was going to take about 20 years. And the amazing thing, Stefan, is that it caused barely a ripple. Where's the outcry? It's astonishing to me, too. 20 years. What if you had said at the start of the Vietnam conflict, well, you know, we're going to be at this for 20 years. What would that have been like? And yet we're hearing this with children yet unborn going to be affected, maybe directly involved in this conflict. And I'm not hearing much about it.
It is astonishing to me. It's going to be extraordinarily profitable for a small group of people. I mean, really extraordinary. Enormous fortunes have been made out of this deal. But from the point of view of the general well-being of the planet, at every level, from the individual literally to the planetary, this vast expenditure of human capital and money and social organization, this disruption of social organization, is going to haunt us for at least one, and as I say, probably two generations. I mean, it's not safe. For instance, as I said earlier, you know, I lived in Egypt. Today, it wouldn't be safe for me to go there. I actually wanted to go there recently, and I was advised by friends in the State Department that really wouldn't be a very good idea, because it was dangerous and there was a chance I might get kidnapped and, I mean, just all the usual stuff. That's horrible, and it arises because of this constant and endless war. It's taken on Orwellian proportions, and that's why I'm make a little plug. I'm doing a workshop, an online workshop that anybody can take, that you don't have to go anywhere. If you go to stephanaschwartz.com, you can sign up for it. But the reason I did this is that I think we're simply not getting there at the governmental level. We have to get there at the individual level. We have got to change the consciousness of America. And that means we got to change the consciousness of Americans, not in a particular way. I mean, it's not about joining a political party or something. But we have got to get people to see by our own beingness, we are our own witnesses, that compassionate and life-affirming choices produce better outcomes. Because the choices we're making are not producing good outcomes. 3 out of 4 Americans, 76%, over 3 out of 4, are unhappy, list themselves as unhappy, dissatisfied, and unfulfilled. That's extraordinary if you think about it for a minute. 3 out of 4 people feel that their lives are unhappy and unfulfilled and creating stress. Very hard to have a functional country when 3/4 of your population feel are miserable. So this has got to be changed from the bottom up, and it's changed by changing beingness. That's why I do these radio interviews. That's why I write all this stuff, because I've spent a long time looking at geopolitical trends, just as you say, and I come away again and again with the conclusion that if it's not going to happen at the top, we don't have visionaries like Franklin Roosevelt. If it isn't going to happen at the top, then it's got to happen at the bottom, and it's got to happen one person at a time. And it has to happen by making different choices.
That term grassroots is going to come back in vogue then.
Well, I certainly hope so, because the alternatives that I see are so grim. The global climate change stuff. I mean, we have one political party in this country that doesn't believe global climate change exists. You can't talk about it. I mean, literally, you can't talk about it. In North Carolina, the Senate won't permit it to be discussed. In Virginia, you can't mention it. And yet, cities like Virginia Beach or Norfolk, well, whatever they're doing at the state level, at the local level, these cities are going underwater. Seattle, Florida,
much of Louisiana,
area, Fort Myers. I mean, it's all going to disappear. You can look.
We're
at
up in Sarasota, so I hope it. I want people to take note. We live in Sarasota, and we're about 6 miles from the Gulf. We may have Gulf front property before we know it here.
There you go.
But in particular, there's a tremendous amount of this loss of land in Louisiana. It's shocking.
Oh my goodness gracious! Absolutely. If you look, just you don't even have to look at what the future holds. Just look at what's happened over the last 15 years. You can get the maps. Just do a Google on it. You can see these interactive maps and see exactly what you're saying, that I was astonished. I hadn't really fully appreciated what's happening along the Gulf Coast. It's just disappearing.
You know, Stefan, I'm thinking about what you said earlier, and there's some kind of balance or something I'm looking for in the conversation that has to do with the grassroots effort, with the idea that 10% of any group can make a big difference. And I also think about the Wall Street sit-ins that we had just a short time ago that harkened back to the 1960s, and yet it didn't really get where it wanted to go. It was kind of, you know, kind of a stillborn, as it were.
Yeah.
What was your feeling about those Wall Street sit-ins? Because it was all over. It was even here. I mean, big cities.
I know exactly. I've thought about it. Well, I'm just finishing a new book. It's not out yet, called Agents of Change, which is about how individuals and small groups change history. And what happened? And what I learned out of doing about 16 years worth of research on this is that in order for a group to make a change, they have to really follow sort of 8 basic rules. Because if you look at all the successful social transformational movements that have worked in this country, or anywhere in the world for that matter, you see that they all work out these 8 rules one way or another. And one of them is, and the one that caused Occupy to collapse is that, or not to be as effective, not collapse isn't quite right, but not to be as effective as it could have been, is that you have to, one of the rules is in a socially progressive movement, is that everybody has to have fundamental equality, but you have to recognize the hierarchical nature of an organizational effort. And they were never able to do that. In fact, they deliberately tried to avoid doing that. They didn't want any leaders to come forward. It was supposed to be this sort of big, anonymous, inchoate mass that was going to make a difference. But unfortunately, because it didn't produce spokespersons, there was nobody that the media could focus on. And whether you like it or not, we live in a social media, electronic media driven world, and there was no one to focus on. It was just this, as I say, this sort of inchoate, anonymous mass of people. And because they didn't bring forward a leader that could articulate what it was about, it never quite gelled and never had the impact that it could and should have had. And because it didn't, it violated one of the 8 laws. And these laws, I mean, they're not at all what you would think, or they certainly weren't what I thought when I began doing this research. I mean,
have to talk about it the next time, Stefan, because we've run out of time today.
It's an issue that will be revisited, including on air between you and us, if you are willing, Stefan. Thanks so much. You are a true intellectual, and we always like having you on with us. Stefan A. Schwartz. Google that name. Stephanaschwartz. Google it. You'll find how to get on his newsletter, his listserv, which is just fantastic. We're going to be back next Friday, 10 a.m. Pacific. Hope you will join us then. Stay tuned for Tech Talk with our buddy Craig Walker. In the meantime, have a great weekend, everybody.